Long ago, in a galaxy far, far away, a podcast called Graphic Policy Radio started periodically covering wars in the stars. They called it Star Wars. We do this when there's a Star Wars story that feels particularly rich in political themes and less like an empty cash grab. This is one of those times. This is your host, Ilana Levin, and joining me today to talk about Bad Batch Season 3, as well as the new miniseries, Tales of the Empire, is Professor Holly Raymond. Holly Raymond is a scholar and writer who teaches at Temple University and Temple Japan. Her books include Maul is Lost and Heaven's Wish to Destroy All Minds. Her poetry can be found in the anthologies We Want It All, an anthology of radical trans poets, and Dead Fellows' Little Black Book. Her writings on Grant Morrison, the X-Men, and the Messianic Gaze can be found on Shelf Dust. And she's been a guest on Cerebro, Strange Horizons, Queers at the End of the World, and of course, Graphic Policy Radio, where she was here last time to talk about Bad Batch as well. She also has read all of the Star Wars. Welcome back. I definitely recommend folks, if you have not heard our Bad Batch episode from before, check it out. I'm really happy with it. Holly's an amazing guest. And she also gives a little bit of her background on how it is she came to be someone who's read all the Star Wars. But check that out. And, you know, today I think we're going to really dive into season 3 of Bad Batch, as well as, the newest sort of Clone Wars animation spinoff reunion. I will say that with the Tales of the Empire miniseries, I did not love the first episode, but the rest of the series did grow on me. So I think if anybody hasn't watched it yet, if you enjoy Star Wars animation-y things, then you'll probably enjoy it. Go watch it and then come back. There's two big storylines in it. And also, I feel like if you don't like one, you'll like the other. So check that out. And I guess from here on out, there will be spoilers for the entirety of Bad Batch Season 3, as well as Tales of the Empire. Holly, what did you think about Season 3 of Bad Batch overall?
I was really satisfied with it. I definitely felt a little bit of trepidation after the sort of penultimate episode, just because it felt like there was still a lot to resolve. And I feel like on the level of sort of fan wang kind of mechanical questions, there still are things I would have enjoyed having clarified. But I think as a story about this particular kind of idiosyncratic family unit, I was really satisfied with how everything shook out. I was rewatching it earlier this week and through, you know, just routine procrastination, only got around to the final episode again this afternoon. And on a rewatch, I was really kind of astonished at how satisfied I was with how they tied off kind of where Omega in particular had wound up.
I personally felt like, you know, this is a series I've enjoyed a lot. I feel like I did not enjoy this season as much, but I'm so invested in these characters that even if there's times where I'm feeling like there's certain shortcomings, particularly in how everything is completely fucking dark, I'm still in it to see it through because I want to know what happens with them, you know?
Yeah.
And I did a little bit of rewatching in preparation for this, and I felt like there was one episode that I really enjoyed rewatching, which is actually, no, there was two that I liked. There was Reunited, which is the first one after they get Crosshairs back, like on the ice planet. And then the episode, I believe it's immediately following that, but were both really, really strong for me. But, you know, I don't want to sound like I'm damning with faint praise. Like if I didn't enjoy season 3, we wouldn't be covering it now. But I just felt like there was a lot of really dark animation where it felt like they were trying to save money by not needing to depict everything on the frame. And that's always a little disappointing. I do think that the series provided a satisfying ending for the characters, for sure, though.
I had heard something, and this is, you know, unconfirmed and just hearsay, but I don't know if you ran into this, and this is sort of jumping laterally, but circling back. There was one episode of Tales of the Empire where the color was just really kind of almost like blacklight poster saturated. And my wife, Abby, and I, as we were watching it, were sort of like debating the merits of this aesthetic choice. And it turned out it was a, I guess, color grading error that Disney Plus corrected after we'd watched it. And so I looked into this, and apparently like the color, like saturation issue with the Bad Batch in general was really glaring on some screens and monitors and less glaring on others. I definitely feel like our weekly first watch on our TV in our living room, I definitely was often thinking, like, I guess it's a little dark. Like, I guess I can see where people's complaints are coming from, but it seems fine to me. Versus watching it on my laptop over the course of this week, there were moments where I was like, I truly have no idea what's going on. So I'm really not sure where the issue's coming from. But it does skew very heavily towards laser bolts flashing in the nighttime, which I've heard from people with epilepsy or other seizure conditions was really sort of deleterious to their ability to appreciate the episodes in a way that, like, I tried to mitigate in the past by putting some sort of filter over the Inquisitor's spinning lightsabers and Rebels, which raises the questions of why they just opted out of doing that this time.
Huh. I mean, I just suspect anytime I can't see everything clearly on frame is people trying to save money, not paying animators enough.
Yeah. You're a big Rebels fan, right?
Oh, yes.
I feel like it just has such a different aesthetic character than Rebels, which leans so hard into the sort of Ralph McQuarrie kind of vintage sci-fi look that I really loved for that show. And I do wonder if, like, some of the murkiness of the Bad Batch, which I think has sort of been endemic to it from the beginning, is just sort of a feint towards a more, like a Wages of Fear type murkiness. I mean, I don't know. I do miss the sort of crispness of Rebels.
One of these days, you and I will be doing a Rebels series for sure. But, you know, I think that the first season of Rebels is fucking heinous and, like, barely tolerable to witness. I watched it despite how heinous it looked. But by the last season of Rebels, there was some good looking animation. Yes.
I really liked what the Clone Wars did within its budget. I liked the fact that everybody kind of looked like a mannequin carved from wood. I thought it gave it a really great stylized look. I liked the sort of sheen and sort of sunniness of a lot of the designs in Rebels. I think, and this is sort of, you know, tangential to the lighting issue, I feel like the Bad Batch has had some of the most kind of convincing and most nuanced character models of any of these shows. But I feel like in season two in particular, they sometimes lapsed into sort of an uncanny valley area where the lips and the eyebrows were almost like too good over these sort of like lifeless noses. I swear to God, we might have gotten into this last time, but there was...
We 100% talked about this last time. Well, because you also were the first person who convinced me that, like, there was an aesthetic choice happening in, like, the way Clone Wars looked, and it wasn't just based on DreamWorks and people being lazy and how 3D animation all looks like ass. Like, you totally sold me on, like, there's, you know, the wooden sculpted puppets as art, you know? But they have us on the hook for this cast that we care so much about from the other seasons. Of course we're going to watch it, you know? It's funny. Somebody sent in, we got a lot of good questions sent in to us via our friends on the Cerebro message board. And I confess, I'm going to basically just be going off of a lot of your amazing listener questions. But one of the people was saying, like, so who's your favorite character this season other than Crosshair? I think we should just talk about the fact that he needed to say other than Crosshair and just dive into Crosshair and how interesting he was this season.
I mean, Crosshair was remarkable. I feel like he has always been such a fascinating character in this show, down to, I mean, they all have their little visual quirks aside from, as we got into last year, all of them being whiter than every other Django. But Crosshair has that sort of cropped silvery hair with that sort of Steve McQueen sneer. Like, he's immediately visually such an arresting character who is kept off screen in such a tantalizing way for so much of season one, that whenever we get more of him throughout the first two thirds of the series, it's really kind of a treat. So one of my sort of fears heading into this season, I think watching the trailer, a lot of people had sort of surmised that we'd be getting a lot more of him. I sort of had this fear that it might be too much of a good thing and that you kind of risked oversaturation with someone who worked so well because of his terseness and sort of the really kind of like hyper efficient kind of like economy of his movements and things like that. But I loved so much about his arc in this season. I loved seeing him not only in sort of a relationship of care that we hadn't really gotten to see prior, but also in sort of positions of precarity and vulnerability himself. I think him dealing with sort of the persistent injury to his hand, and particularly point of no return, I think, where he kind of has that Hail Mary shot to get the tracker on the ship and fails.
Oh, so good.
Yeah. Was really kind of remarkable character work, but not showy. Like, there was never a sense of having, like, this is the very special Crosshair episode. Or, you know, this is the somewhat didactic, like, PTSD for Crosshair episode.
Yeah. Subtler, too. It's like, what is the, is it a hand injury? I kind of viewed it as being like a sign of shell shock rather than like a physical. I mean, it's neurological. Neurological is physical, yeah. But it's different than like, I broke a bone and it didn't heal right, you know?
Right.
At least that was how I kind of read it. But I actually don't know if they are more specific or if they are just leaving it to us to sort of interpret it as we will.
I think you're right. I think the implication is that it's neurological. Yeah. If I recall, the little floating droid doctor buddy they have on Pabu seems more or less happy to let Omega try the sort of meditation practice with him rather than being like, no, we need like a surgical intervention. But then, of course, by the end of the series, it's a moot point because he doesn't have that hand anymore.
Yeah, I had a lot of thoughts about that. Do you want to talk about that as well? Somebody had commented that they were like, doesn't it seem like there's a lot of people losing limbs in Star Wars? And I just was like, based on how it happens in war, no, I don't think there's a lot of people losing limbs in Star Wars relative to how much that happens in war.
I'd agree with that. I think it is a compromise. It's never really struck me as super unsatisfying where it is a story about a war. And so people not coming home with everything they left with feels right to me. But at the same time, it's, you know, it's a family movie franchise and it's a cartoon show on Disney Plus. You're not going to get people being disemboweled.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that motif of hand injury has become sort of like a Star Wars tick for a reason, because it does signify this grievous permanent harm. But we've also established way back in like 1980 that is something you can get more or less seamlessly addressed with prosthetics in this universe.
You know, which we don't see him doing. And I mean, you have to wonder if there is an issue of like access that happens, right?
Especially because I feel like he's not going to Coruscant.
Mm-hmm.
One really small moment that I noticed in the last episode, rewatching it tonight, is the very last shot right before the little flash forward. Hunter and Omega are sitting on this little planter and she leans her head on his shoulders and we see Wrecker and Crosshair come up and join them. And I was talking to our mutual friend Dylan about this earlier today, about the score by the Kiners, which I think has been really, really beautiful this season. Where you have this little motif that I kind of associate with Omega in particular, this kind of really kind of sweet lilting melody that's usually kind of woven in with woodwinds and string. Whereas Crosshair and Wrecker sit on either side of Hunter and Omega, we hear her motif, and again, just what I'm calling her motif, kind of swell back in, but with the brass added in, as if to say, like, throughout the series, I feel like they use that motif so sparingly that it's like there's this sweetness and this lightness that she brings, but that they can't afford to sustain for very long. And here at the very end of this ordeal they've gone through, it can sort of assert itself at the forefront of the composition with this more martial brass. But as this
That's
is happening,
so astute, yeah.
There's this great little piece of animation where we see Wrecker and Crosshair sit kind of ramrod straight spines, like very military posture. Crosshair in particular is sitting in such a way that the missing hand is sort of supporting his shoulders, as if sort of like digging into this point of pain, this point of hurt, which I think is something that we see him doing over and over from season one. But then they all exchange glances and you see Wrecker's sort of shoulders round and sort of soften. And you see Crosshair just completely relax his posture like he's releasing a huge sigh. And you see him kind of shift so that he opens his other hand onto the palm of his thigh and kind of readjusts where he's kind of angling the support of the weight of his upper body.
Yeah.
And it just felt like such a keenly observed little piece of like animation and scoring that, you know, he's not a character that's ever going to have a monologue about his healing. He's not going to have, you know, a soliloquy about what he's been carrying with him and, you know, what regrets he has. And I think the show, with him in particular, has so consistently let these little kind of micro decisions of animation and kind of physical acting tell that story for him in a way that I think, you know, along with a lot of the other really sort of nuanced character acting in this show, more or less makes up for some of the weird like lighting and pacing issues.
I think you were really right though, like how it showed like he was not going to keep digging into the pain. He was going to adjust it to like accommodate himself better. And I was like, oh my God, Holly, that's so astute. Yeah. Like they can do those moments of physical characterization when they really want to. And they still can stage a great action sequence. I mean, this season, you really get to see Omega come into her own as a full, you know, young leader and like lead the little children to freedom. And they sequence that so well. And you can really see how she is like able to draw on the skills she's learned from all of the different members of the batch over the years, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And there's such a great moment with Echo where he like just really hits you over the head with that by saying it in case you've missed it. Oh my God, freeing the Godzilla with the big slappy fingers from the planet of arms for legs. Like, so gratifying. And I love how like Tarkin is just like, he told you it was going to get loose. It got loose. And like the fact that we have no resolution of what happens with it next is, I just like to think he's out there living his best life on that planet, draining the energy from everything and roaring.
Yeah, I imagine the Zillow Beast happy. I do love the runner with Tarkin this season. He has no fucking conception of what's going on this planet. He just knows that he doesn't approve of it.
Totally, yeah.
Which I think is a nice note for Tarkin. He is not going to busy himself with the minutiae of what Hemlock is doing, but he has made the snap judgment, in this case justified, that what Hemlock is doing is probably monstrous even compared to the baseline of, you know, Imperial military products. And that, frankly, I think the impression is that he just doesn't see a lot of merit in Hemlock as a person. And this is conveyed without him really ever getting an in into the narrative as such.
Well, his complaint isn't like, this is a bridge too far. His complaint is just like, this is weird, and I don't approve of things that are weird. This is some magic shit.
Yeah, it's unseemly. It's from the perspective of Tarkin, sort of anti-materialist in a way that he's suspicious of. And more than that, I think to him, it sort of reeks of sort of bureaucracy and technocracy in a way that he's hostile to. Because I think canon Tarkin, you know, opposed to Legends Tarkin, is like one of the flagship, like unexpected butches of the franchise. He does not have a lot of time for stuff that does not have this sort of like hard-sinewed military athleticism to it, which I think is something like, I always feel like I have to resist kind of like back on like a unified theory of Star Wars canon, because frankly, there's a lot of it. And I don't think anyone involved with the Bad Batch has any reasonable expectation to be on top of every comic book Tarkin has ever been in. But it's a consistent runner with him that he's a guy who, if he can take off his shirt to show off, you know, the scars on his six pack, he will, even in his 70s or early 80s or however old he is, which is very much not the Tantus milieu.
How do you feel about Hemlock from this season? I love an evil whispering villain. He's got like such like fucking Dr. Mengele vibes. I was thinking he seems like he is the evil version of Dr. Bashir.
Funny you should mention that, because Alexander Siddig is in this season.
Who was he? He wasn't Hemlock.
He's Governor Singh, I think.
Oh, I love that. Oh, wow. Okay.
Abby and I are big Bashir heads. I think DS9 is probably our most rewatched show.
Obviously, you know, I'm a DS9 podcast host, so big fan.
I think reading him as sort of like kind of like a Klipothic Bashir of sorts is really sharp. He is a character where I wish we had gotten a little bit more of what's going on beneath the hood, just because I think Jimmy Simpson's performance is so compelling. We had been watching It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia shortly before this season started, and he, of course, is one of the like sweating incest brothers on that show.
Oh, okay. Like, I was this not aware complete of kind that of like, as a category of people.
He's like this complete like grand guignol like figure of abjection that occasionally like shows up once or twice a season to like cause fucking problems. Like a complete sort of like comedy grotesque character. But I think he has such an air of like, he does a really good job of something I think is tricky, which is giving a facade of being collected, but making it very clear that this is a pretty thin facade.
Yeah, totally.
I think in the last episode, when he is panicking and terrified and just sort of losing his mind with anxiety and rage, and there's a couple line readings where he sounds like a completely different guy almost. At the same time, it's so evidently who has been there beneath that sort of like really methodical, really almost like, I don't want to say ASMR like, but that almost like somnolent delivery he has. Mm-hmm. And it's a note that I think we don't get that often from Star Wars antagonists.
Yeah, I'm really glad that he died. That was fun. I liked how he died. A little moment of trust building that those guys got. I know you have a lot of enthusiasm about Omega's development here as well. And we've always, you know, we continue to have perhaps more questions than answers when it comes to our biological clone of Jango, the young girl. Mm-hmm. Let's talk about Omega this season and what we now know and what doesn't matter and what matters still. Yeah. I'm really happy she's not going straight up Jedi. I think it's so cool to have a character where we see they have that potential, but that just isn't what they're going to do because biology isn't destiny.
Right. And I like that it also, to circle back a little bit to the Zillow Beast, it's been so consistent with her throughout this series that she has a knack with animals. I think we see it especially this season, not only with her deciding to, you know, obviously she's kind of instrumentalizing the Zillow Beast, but she's also giving it a life beyond being chained up and electrocuted all the time, but obviously with Batcher as well. And I remember seeing kind of posts and scuttlebutt online about how like, oh, maybe her connection with animals is sort of a signifier of force sensitivity or something like that. And I think they left it in a place where you can believe that if you want, but it's also quite clear that she is good with animals because she is just a person with a degree of empathy that is unusual in the world she lives in. You know, she doesn't risk her safety to help this little frog dog thing necessarily because she has a magic power. She does it because she does not want to see something exploited and abused continue to get exploited and abused. It sort of, I think, recenters what's remarkable about her away from, you know, like you gestured at, this somewhat kind of like facile sense of like biological predestination, but towards just like she's admirable and she's compelling because she has a worked out sense of ethics.
Do we feel like she had any particular challenges or limitations as a person that she had to overcome, or it really feels mostly like it just was a matter of growing up, period?
I mean, I feel like it with her, and I don't necessarily mind this, I feel like it sort of sticks to like a pretty conventional like buildings Ramon. She doesn't really have any big flaws to overcome aside from being young. Yeah. And, you know, she certainly starts the show a little bit more naive and kind of wide-eyed than she ends it. But I don't get the sense that the show is suggesting that she grows by losing her, you know, sort of fundamental sense of kind of investment and interest in other living things. No, I don't really think she has much of a journey of like remediation to go through.
Yeah, and that's fine. I wasn't sure if there was something I hadn't seen.
I feel like it's more legible in the context of the last couple major Star Wars things, where it's more about her embodying a kind of heroism that is a little bit new for this franchise, where I do think for a long time there was this sort of uneasy sense of like, if you are special, you will get these capacities that let you have a longer lever with which to move things in the world, right? Which isn't to say that the stories that sort of lean on that are bad, but I do feel like it is something they've been moving away from. We didn't get a chance to talk earlier this year, or Christ, was it earlier this year? Whenever Ahsoka came out.
Yeah. But I really did not like that show. And I just did not feel like I wanted to spend my limited time on this earth explaining to people why. So I just was like, I'm not going to cover it.
It had its moments. I think it's a show I would sort of struggle to fill an hour with. But one thing I did like was this idea that almost everything we've been told about the Force as this kind of almost like X-gene adjacent, usually somewhat eugenics-y inequality has been incorrect. And that, you know, someone like Sabine Wren could have every indicator that they would simply be totally inert with the Force. But that's reframed as a problem of pedagogy rather than a problem of destiny or biology, which I really, really liked, and which I feel kind of dovetails with how the comics to a certain extent have been going with my like number one Star Wars hobby horse, which is that the droids are just sort of treated like shit on the universal level, and it's never really addressed. There's this great moment in an issue of the mainline title, maybe about a year ago, where there's this big plot that we don't need to get into about droids going haywire and this very old kind of droid intelligence trying to figure out the Force. And there's this part where Luke kind of thinks about it and is like, there's really no reason why a droid couldn't be in contact with the Force. They have subjectivity, they have agency, they have, by all appearances, will. There's this sense of kind of a demoticization of the Force, that it's not sort of the purview of this sort of like theological aristocracy. Mm-hmm. And so I think from that regard, and with the sort of flirting and very strategic sort of withdrawing that this show does with, you know, is Omega Force sensitive? Is she not Force sensitive? Could she kind of learn to, you know, throw pebbles around if she worked hard at it? Could she not? I think the way that that throws those questions out there and then makes the argument that the answers to those are completely immaterial to her capacity to help people, to sort of be an instrument against injustice, to be, you know, loved by those close to her, to be someone who provides care and support to those close to her. It doesn't really matter what her, you know, midichlorian count is. And so I think it's less about an educational voyage for Omega, so much as she is sort of the vehicle for a kind of educational voyage for audiences who have spent the past, whatever, 45 years or so thinking they knew how the grammar of this setting worked.
Yes, that's so smart. Yeah. From a listener question, what do you think was the purpose and utility of Omega and Emery being both specifically, quote, unaltered clones of Jango Fett, quote, and women? The gender element specifically never came up as anything unusual or mysterious to unpack. Do you think there was an abandoned storyline here? Beyond the scope of Omega and Emery, what do we think we can extrapolate about clones and strand cast and the relationship with gender, self-identity, and or sexuality?
Thought about this a lot because I am kind of very choosy about what I want from trans narratives. And to me, I always have a sort of reflexive, like, sour face about stories where someone is, you know, shape-shifted against their will or is a clone of someone else or something like that. Because to me, transness is so agential and is so contingent upon, you know, getting out of bed every morning and making a series of micro and macro decisions about how you're going to embody yourself. It is not that interesting of a story to me when it's something that happens to a character. I'm more interested when it is something that a character does. So I guess the discoursey thing throughout the past two seasons of this show, was like, is Omega like legible as a trans character? Is Emery Carr legible as a trans character? I would say if different storytelling decisions had been made, I'd be more persuaded. We do have, in the extended kind of novel sphere, a character who comes up very, very briefly and is not exactly like, I don't get the impression that they got Tori Peters to come in for a paragraph. But there is a character named Sister, who is a trans woman who is a clone trooper. And it's a little bit of an infamous character because Anakin gets kind of a little cringy scene where he kind of acts like he has invented the term transgender. She is in a novel called Queen's Hope by E.K. Johnston. It is one of her quite fun novels about Padme and her handmaidens. And then she has a cameo, I think, in the novel Brotherhood by Mike Chen, which I really, really loved as sort of a rehabilitative reading of the Nimoidians. But we do have there an example of a trans woman who has made the decision to transition and who we see in the little snippet we get going through this process with the people in her life of sort of relearning how to be around them, which I think is really interesting. She's a character that I would love to see a lot more of, you know, preferably by a trans author, which is not a knock on E.K. Johnston or Mike Chen, but it's just something I would prefer to see. Whereas I think Omega, you know, obviously I adore Omega. I think Emery Carr is an interesting character. Up until this afternoon, for some godforsaken reason, I thought all the other scientists on Mount Tantus were also clones. I guess that's apparently not the case, but sure, I'd like to see more of them too. But I don't think the scaffolding and sort of the particular kind of character work I personally gravitate towards is there to make that trans reading of them in particular. I do think it's really interesting that we do see this sort of implication that the men are kind of made into little Jangos and sent off to war, whereas both Emery and Omega seem like they were being cultivated for more of the role that Emery ultimately winds up in.
Scientist. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. There's this weird tension that I think Star Wars canon has had to dance with, not always successfully, about, like, you know, the Empire is ostensibly, of course, a deeply evil and genocidal fascist regime, but it is not racist and it is not sexist, which has always felt unpersuasive to me.
Same.
Just because I don't think that's how fascism is equipped to work.
And when they're thinking hard and given freedom, they tend to make choices like the tendency of officers to be British accents, for example. Like, they do periodically acknowledge the ways a person's identity maps into their ability to hold power in effect. They, you know, they do tend to only have be human, you know, things like that. Mm-hmm. Periodically, they'll remember, like, oh, yeah, fascists, right, white supremacy. But then sometimes they're like, we have to have, you know, can't have our Nazis not be black at times, or women.
So I do think it's funny that there is kind of an all dogs are boys, all cats are girls element to, you know, if we want the scientist clones, they need to be women. Which, again, I don't know why I thought that all of the scientists on Tantus were clones. I guess either way, it's a little, if they're not clones, it's a little peculiar to me that Hemlock has assembled his sort of all girl Mengele squad with all brown hair. But I'm not.
So then
his
he's
mom.
Just like Wotan from Wictiv. I'd buy it.
She is. Oh man, she is.
You know.
Oh my god.
Go read Wicked and Divide, folks. But you know, I mean, I just think it's like, I truly think that the sad reality is the people who create these shows don't think nearly as much about gender and identity as those of us who watch it do. And so at no point did it occur to them that it might be what it might imply that there is direct unaltered clones of this guy who aren't men. You know, so, it was the same issue, the same story with Wolverine's clone Laura in the X-Men, right? Like, we all thought about what that meant, but the people making those choices, like, they don't fucking think about gender. I don't know, man. It's got to be a strange world out there being cishet. You'll have to tell me all about it someday, somebody. But they don't think about it. So they're not actually writing a story with that implication in mind. So I think when you dig, it isn't super satisfying. But there's certainly nothing wrong with people wanting to read her that way, for sure. You're putting more in than it did, you know?
If that's the reading that brings people joy and, like, makes the text more meaningful to them, I support it. Like, in the same way, like, someone came up to me on the street for some reason and I guess had the extremely bizarre icebreaker, Zuckuss, the Gand bounty hunter from 5 Seconds of the Empire Strikes Back, is heterosexual. That's their thing to believe, but it's not my Star Wars. There's also the theory of trans Jango, which I think is kind of a fun workaround.
That Jango is trans.
Yeah, that Jango is a trans man, which, again, to go back to the X-23 of it all, you know, is the popular fan reading of Logan Wolverine as well. And there is actually a really, I don't know if you know this, I'm going to find the title real quick, but the cartoonist Andy Stevenson.
Oh, yeah. He did an amazing comic strip. Oh, my God.
Which isn't necessarily a comic about trans Jango Fett, but
no,
it digs into a lot
Jango
of stuff.
Jango Fett's
with,
trans partner.
Yeah.
Basically.
And, you know, sort of what that sort of like explicitly queer family model means for a clone, which, because, you know, as we discussed last season, whether or not the showrunners intended it to or not, there's a lot that's queer about the clone army and the way that we see them socializing, and especially in this series, the way that we see them sort of forming kind of ad hoc family units. And I think that Stevenson comic, the title is This Place Was Home, which you can just sort of get on Google if you're listening.
Mm-hmm. And you should. It's amazing.
It is one of the best Star Wars stories. As far as I'm concerned, it's canon.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think it's another one of those areas where, again, I really love this show in a lot of ways, but I think it's a conversation that in 2024 is unlikely to be super generative on a Disney Plus cartoon show. This is an area where I think some of the print publishing stuff is a little bit ahead of the TV and film, where in the past couple of years, we have started to see a fair number of textually trans and non-binary characters, more so in the novels, more so in the comics, although we do have that non-binary Jedi or Padawan or whatever they were in the second to last episode of Tales of the Empire, which we can maybe get around to when we get to there.
I will say that I feel like we hear Barriss use they, them to refer to a number of people in a way that makes me think that they can also couch it as being like, well, just Barriss uses they, them to refer to people when Barriss doesn't know what pronouns to use for someone, if. Which is also great. I actually noted that Barriss uses they, them, not just towards the Jedi, but there was also somebody else as well in that last episode I noticed.
Well, this is a total sidetrack, but I feel like the sort of person who will be listening to this episode would find it germane. Are you watching X-Men 97?
Oh, of course. Absolutely. And Stephen and I did our coverage of the first two episodes was the last thing we were able to work on together. And I'm taping X-Men 97 in coverage, I guess, in about a week for the rest of the series.
Right. And like, I remember reading before the series started that the show would not be using they, them pronouns for Morph. But then I've noticed that the show does at times.
Yeah.
Which has been a really pleasant surprise to me. And I think like a nice index of kind of incremental change. You can see that in both X-Men and Star Wars, these very like marquee franchises. And then, you know, of course, Star Wars has gotten such good work out of Alyssa Wong, a prominent non-binary author as well. It just feels like there is more space opening up, not only for these queer narratives, but for them to be told by, you know, queer artists and queer authors. Which, to circle back around like 20 minutes, I guess is to say, I think with gender and clone subjectivity, the Bad Batch has more interesting questions than it does answers. But I also think that that is not the worst thing in the world for what this show is.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense to me. Yeah. But I do think, like, I also do find it kind of funny that there's just a ton of stuff that's being made by cis people where it doesn't occur to them that, like, something just seems to be clearly trans because they just don't fucking think that hard.
Right.
It's very strange to me, but it seems to be true. I don't know. If it doesn't occur to people that something's even possible, then it doesn't occur to you that you've actually said it. But I really was curious, like, if they were going to look at all us, like, well, why does Emery, like, why are there clone scientists? Like, there's a reason why there's clone soldiers. The clone soldiers is because nobody wants to give their kid to die for the Empire. Right. But with the scientists, like, why do you need clone scientists? Well, it's so you can control scientists is reason, right?
Yeah, like, to be completely frank, I think they made clone scientists so that they could have a reveal where someone says she's Omega's sister.
Sure.
Like, I'm not sure at the end of the day there was a lot more to it than the structural value of that reveal, which, to be clear, I think was a really killer reveal.
I also think it gives Omega a moment to reflect, to also be like, I could become an adult.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah. I hadn't thought of that, but yeah.
Like, I feel like that was a moment where she, because that was how I read it in her reaction, you know?
Yeah. No, that's so I'm adopted, which means that when I was growing up, you know, I loved my parents very much and they loved me. And it never felt unusual to me in the moment to not be able to look into their faces and sort of have a projection of what I might look like when I was older. And that never really struck me as unusual until I started spending a lot of time with my in-laws, both of whom do really, really look like Abby in different ways. And suddenly thinking like, I guess it's kind of just the norm that people who, you know, are brought up by their biological parents have this sort of like genetic mirror that they can consult whenever they want to. And, you know, by that point, I was old enough that it was really just like, huh, interesting. But I do think that there's a lot of value in it for Omega in particular, who is growing up surrounded only by these sort of differently gendered iterations of her own face. And I mean, you know, the elephant in the room is, you know, that Emery doesn't necessarily look like an older sister to Omega because Omega is several shades of gradation whiter than most of the other clones, as we discussed last season. But I do really like that read on what that sort of like visual continuity between them might suggest and what work it might be doing.
Yeah. Another great moment we have with her that we both are kind of obsessed with is when she goes and tries to teach Crosshair how to meditate because she learned how to do that meditation from Gunji.
Yeah.
I mean, I think you had mentioned that you thought it was interesting to see somebody use Jedi powers in a non-combat nor non-superheroic kind of way, just the way a normal person would use those like mindfulness tools.
So Abby and I went and saw The Phantom Menace last weekend, which we hadn't seen in a while. And it sort of brought home something that's kind of really weird to me about the world building in Star Wars, which is that the Jedi Order and like the sort of Jedi code and everything are treated in a lot of ways as a religious practice. But for all intents and purposes, it appears to be a religion that is only practiced by its own priests. Whereas like you never really see lay people out in the world who kind of seem to take any solace or like mindfulness from the Jedi mantras or like, again, I feel like it's so thinly sketched out that I can't even think of other examples for what Jedi do other than superpowers and wearing ropes. But like, you know, obviously in the original trilogy, if you are not actively a Jedi or becoming a Jedi or a former Jedi, we meet characters who just don't even believe that they were at all what they were cracked up to be. Tarkin is skeptical of them. Han Solo is skeptical of them. Uncle Owen, I guess, seems more or less skeptical of them.
I think.
But even in the prequel trilogies, like, and this is partially just because we spend so little time with civilians in those movies. But the closest we see is, and I, you know, he is what he is. I love the moment with Watto where Qui-Gon Jinn tries to sort of, I think, somewhat monstrously pawn him out of a free spaceship part by using the force trick with him. And Watto seems kind of incredulous that someone would even try that shit. Like, he doesn't sort of freeze up and act like, are you a Jedi? Are you a Jedi Knight coming into my place of business and doing this? He's acting like if someone came into your apartment and sort of started saying Harry Potter spells at you to walk out with your dining room table or something like that. He treats it so flippantly and so derisively as if, like, there's no sense that there's any sort of numinousness or, like, spiritual gravity attached to the concept of the Jedi out on the Outer Rim. Which I think is, on the one hand, probably, like, just a structural issue with the world building of this series and sort of an issue with how narrow its vantage point of the people that live in its setting is, but is also kind of fascinating. Like, what does it mean if you have a religion that is sort of the de facto military arm of the intergalactic government by the time we meet them? It has no practitioners. Like, you don't see evidence of, like, force synagogues or force, you know, mass services. It seems like it's something that's entirely practiced by a really martialized priesthood, which I think is interesting. And so I think it is interesting that we see Omega, who for all intents and purposes is not a Jedi and unlikely to become one, really earnestly finding value and finding some measure of truth in what a Jedi has taught her about his practices.
I really do think that's I mean, it is a very strange part of the world building to that absence. But I actually don't remember if the meditation is Jedi meditation. I mean, she says that she learned it from Gunji, but it could just as easily be something that is like traditional to Chirwook and the Wookiee people. rather than being Jedi more broadly, although it certainly does seem like a Jedi-y thing to do. But
I want to circle back around to that maybe when we get to Barriss, because sure. There's stuff I do want to say about what being a Jedi means for sort of cultural practices being flattened out and some of the ways in which Murielans, the species that Barriss belongs to, sometimes but sporadically add an interesting wrinkle to that. So I guess for now, my one objection would be like, I'm not sure who would have taught him Shiriwook meditation practices.
Because you don't think he would remember his family because they got taken when he was so young.
Yeah. Although, I mean, Wookiees, I think they live a super long time. So maybe he's like 40 when we see him in the Clone Wars.
Yeah, who knows? Well, just because they just seem like when we see Gunji reunited with his people, there's a sense of like, I'm home in a way that feels like you might not necessarily felt if he like barely remembered being there or like, you know.
Yeah, I don't know. That's a good question. I hadn't even thought about it possibly being a Shiriwook thing, but I think it's possible. And that would also be interesting for Omega and sort of this. We see her picking up skills and sort of qualities from so many people that she meets. Obviously, you know, the other members of the Bad Batch, but we see her really effectively hustling people in that little club or tavern or whatever it is in the fourth episode of this season. And thinking like, this is stuff she learned from Sid, the Rhea Perlman character that she learned from, you know, Fi. This is her kind of granting this sort of intrinsic dignity to everyone that she meets, that she goes into interactions thinking, there is something this person can teach me. There is something that I don't have, that knowing them and sort of paying loving attention to them could, you know, impart. But yeah, I think I reflexively took it as a Jedi thing because at that point in the season, it still kind of felt to me like they were leaning more towards maybe having her like levitate a little pendle or something.
Yeah, Well, let's talk about that aspect of the season, her fun times with Asajj Ventress and the analysis of. Yeah, well, how did you think about the show's decision to explore that with her? Should we have had more Asajj? You feel satisfied? I was happy to see Asajj, and I actually was half wondering in that last scene where if she was going to be like with her when she goes to leave the planet, but I'm glad that she has not.
Yeah, I mean, if you had asked me 2 weeks ago to put money on Asajj being in the final episode or not, I would have said, obviously, she's going to be in the final episode. I think ultimately, I'm glad that she wasn't, but it just seemed so foregone to me that one wouldn't have her show up and sort of let the audience have a rundown on who she is and then have her leave again. I think it was nice to see her. I think there's an intrinsic lesbian desire to have Asajj Ventress in every show.
Yeah.
And she did not get the most impressive send-off the last time she was in a canon thing. She was electrocuted, protecting her sort of white dreadlocks boyfriend, Quinlan Vos, from lightning and dumped into a swamp. But yeah, Abby and I had talked about this, where I feel like these cartoons like to have this moment where someone who is sort of at a crossroads about where they want their sort of like Buildings Ramon trajectory to go, have this moment where they flirt with the possibility of taking on a mentor who could lead them somewhere fast, but without the sort of ethical rigor that they need. Obviously, like the really, really rich stuff with Ezra and Darth Maul and Rebels is a good example. And so I think they fainted with that in a nice way of having Asajj kind of show up and have that sort of like hard-bitten edge, but ultimately, you know, largely gives her sound advice. And
yeah, surprisingly,
seems to be looking out for her well-being. And I think above all else, not wanting to see her get pulled into a sort of like life without agency that she feels like she herself was pulled into at an even younger age than Omega.
Yeah.
And then pieces out. I think it was really unconventional plotting. And I think ultimately plotting I really like. You know, I'm going to be a little frustrated if she just never shows up in anything else ever again. But I think for what it was, she was a smart choice for that role, especially knowing now what, you know, wasn't known at the time, which was that Barriss Offee was spoken for in another project. And I think, you know, if she does show up in something else soon, then it was a nice enough refresher. I did really like the reminder that we got in her brief kind of fight scene with the Bad Bat that the Jedi are really fucking good fighters. And that was sort of an asymmetry in the war that everybody in the show is kind of still, you know, kind of reeling from. And I did also like that she had clearly changed from who she was in the Clone Wars in a way that felt believable, but also that I think the show was shrewd to withhold too much exposition about.
What did you feel about the choice to have Omega become a rebel pilot and presumably go hang out with her former friend and now star pilot Hera, back when Hera had her native accent?
I do love that. And that's another area where if we never see a project with Omega flying around in an X-Wing or whatever, I'll understand it and respect it. But, you know, on a gut level, I think to a certain extent, being in fandom spaces is always going to be sort of being outside the candy store, banging on the windows, just saying more candy. And so that side of me definitely, you know, would love to see her pop up in anything else, in the same way that, you know, the prevalence of Hera in other post-Rebels stuff has been, you know, always pleasant, always welcome. And I feel like one of the side effects of making her not commit one way or the other to being a Jedi or doing force training means that it's a little more plausible that she could just be somewhere else during the original trilogy without it being sort of like a big question about like, well, why didn't Luke Skywalker do blah, blah, blah. I like how light of a touch the show had with this idea that for Omega, sitting on the sidelines of this rebellion would be unacceptable. But at the same time, that for Hunter, she would plausibly be able to say, I fought my fight and I'm staying home, without making Omega come off as naive or Hunter come off as cynical. I think that moment worked really, really well. And with the scoring in particular, kind of an inversion of that scene with the four of them by the tree, where it sort of fades from the Bad Batch theme to the sort of Omega motif. During the flash forward, we get that sort of more energetic, more kind of like percussive iteration of the Omega motif with that little blare of trumpet or whatever it is, right as she puts text goggles on the dashboard, that then fades, but opens out into the Bad Batch theme as she flies off. I think that really felt like a really, really satisfying, like, handing off of the baton.
Yeah, it does. It does. One of the things that I thought was, I'm a big fan of Echo, of course. There's a moment in one of my favorite episodes from season three, where, you know, Omega consistently throughout the season keeps saying how bad she feels that she wasn't able to go back and save the other clones. And she's the only person who expects herself to be able to do that, right? Because everybody else is like, dude, that's like really fucking hard. We don't expect you to do that. And it's interesting how she holds herself to that standard the whole time, which is like a goal that is a higher goal than most adults would even hold for themselves as being possible. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. But it's something that Echo says to her that really stuck to me as being like exactly what parents are supposed to say, which is when she finally gets reunited with him, he says, you did exactly what you were supposed to do. You got out of there. I've seen parents explain to kids who've witnessed school shootings or other crisis, other trauma, that like the main thing you need to do is survive. That is your job. That's it. Yeah. And that, you know, we don't expect you to save or like to be able to, you know, like, I know that that's like a thing. And so I thought it was very like proper emotionally healthy parenting guide to raising your child of Echo to point that out to her, because I really know how that is.
I think this show is really smart about letting the Bad Batch be protective of her and being kind of nurturing of her in a way that doesn't sort of regularly feel stifling. Because I think that line is a really well-placed line. And I think comes at a really well-placed moment in the sort of dynamic of Echo and Omega in particular. Because in the last episode, we get sort of a counterpoint to it, where she and Echo and the kids and Emery are all together at long last at the shuttle that's going to get the kids out of there. These kids, you know, some of whom are obviously much younger, much more vulnerable than her. But there's this remarkable moment, I think, where the other kids are getting ferried into the shuttle to go off to safety with Far. And as a viewer, I was expecting a sort of brief back and forth where Echo would be like, you know, Omega, get on in there. and her saying, no, my place is here, and him, you know, back and forth. What I really admired is that that conversation doesn't happen. In that moment, he takes it as given that she is going to stay. It doesn't need to be discussed. It doesn't need to be debated. At that moment, he sees who she's grown into being and what she's already accomplished and knows that, you know, it's not an issue of keeping her out of danger materially. If she stays and tries to help her family, they are likely to be helped. Where it is such good parenting, where he says in that earlier moment, precisely the right thing for the circumstances that she has been in. But he also completely has respect for her capabilities and, you know, more importantly, for her capacity to correctly assess what her own capabilities are and what she feels like she can do and what she feels like she should do. Yeah, I feel like Echo is sometimes such a subdued character that it can feel like there's more to say about Crosshair or last season Tech. But I think in this season, it becomes really clear that as someone who has gone through kind of inordinate amounts of trauma, even compared to these other clone troopers who obviously were functionally hatched out of tubes and immediately sent to the battlefield, he has such an instinctive understanding of who Omega is and what she needs from a mentor figure at a given moment. But I think is also just the most simpatico with her impulse towards wanting to help, even when it doesn't seem practical.
Yes.
He's the one who, you know, not to shame these imaginary clone men for wanting to have
to stay in the fight
and a life on sort of this beautiful island. But with him, it's always an issue of what do the other clones need from me? What can I be doing for them rather than sort of, you know, cooling my heels? And I mean, on the like literal level of the text, there's questions about what that means. I think someone on Cerebro pointed out the very good question of him sort of volunteering other liberated clones for Chantoran military service in the last episode, which is sort of vexed because, you know, we all love Chuchi, but the last time we saw Pantora's military projects as such, it was just waging kind of violent imperialist war on a snow planet with the little fuzzy Tals guys.
I know nothing of the Pantorans other than Senator Chuchi.
Yeah, I think it's one of those things where the text doesn't really want you to be necessarily too hung up on a single episode of the Clone Wars from what, like 15 years ago. But it is sort of there in the grand texture of Star Wars, and I think it is sort of a strange little footnote. But in general, yeah, I do feel like his sense of an ethical imperative is the closest of any of them to what Omega shows over and over again. Mm-hmm. So I think the line you pointed out, you did exactly what you were supposed to do. You got out of there. I got the impression that this is something he's had a lot of practice telling himself.
Speaking of other metaphors, oh God, just Crosshair and like him looking at that weird ice world vulture and that like, how that just brings back everything about that episode from season two and how upset I was at everything that happened. It was an amazing episode, everything that happened there.
It was.
It's sort of like, that's just his, like, that's his ice vulture that, you know, is his symbol, his symbolic animal.
Mm-hmm. I did like that they went back there. I think we talked about this last season, you know, in part just because it was a really stellar episode, but in part because to me, it is such an important episode for sort of the queer clone camaraderie reading. Because last year, I spent that entire episode like truly thinking Crosshairs and the beard guy were going to kiss.
Mayday, which is such an apt name that I remembered it.
Yeah, I think the isolation of that episode and sort of the intimacy that they're thrown into, read it, you know, however you want. But I do think textually, like so much of Crosshair up to that point had been this sort of myth of self-sufficiency that he told himself, with this like sort of contradiction within himself that he was totally his own guy, but he was also totally subsumed into his identity as someone kind of to be a utility for his empire, his army. That in that episode, we saw him with someone else in sort of an extremity of circumstances that forced him to look outside of those kind of like self-mythologies. Like mm-hmm. he had to be so acutely aware that my life right now is me and this other man. And if we are both not extremely acutely tuned into each other and each other's sort of capabilities and needs, we are both just going to die. I feel like it's where he experiences this sort of doubling in himself through knowing someone really, really closely, that he'd previously kind of foreclosed for himself. So it is kind of like for him coming back to his own grave as much as it is coming back to the grave of this person that he'd come to really love, if not, or depend on, if not love, previously. And, you know, obviously on a more kind of like apparent level, I guess, it's where his conception of himself as someone who, what was his little refrain in the early show?
Good soldier follows good, orders.
Yeah. It's where that part of him dies. And so I think it also is an index of his growth by that point in season three that he volunteers the idea of coming back to this place, which I imagine must be, you know,
the last thing he wanted to do. Yeah.
Yeah. Hell for him to revisit. Yeah.
And I just like that that's the episode that really gets the team back together again. And like Echo says, you see, they always work it out. And this time I don't see any blood. It's a great presence. I hope, I don't know. Echo will always be my favorite also. Hey, what did you think about the clone, the XO, what are they called? The CX2 troopers and the hidden troopers and the, you know, it's funny. I didn't really harp too much on the mystery of it until near the very end, when I began to think like, oh God, I'm sure one of them is tech. And then in the final episode, they don't confirm it. And I'm happy with that choice. But it really wasn't until that was even on the table that I was particularly invested in that mystery. I just was like, oh yeah, reconditioned clones who've been completely dehumanized and are now just operating as tools. Like that is actually what the real threat is for them, is that they could end up like that. Like that's the fate that's worse than death, you know?
I think that's persuasive. I really didn't want it to be tech just because I thought that would have been a little cheesy. But I did have a moment of doubt when the other guys start kind of clambering out of their tubes and it sort of looks like there's a big guy. It sort of looks like there's kind of a huntery looking like live guy. Mm-hmm. And I had a moment of like, oh, did they make like other like a worse batch?
I thought that too then as well.
But no, I think you're right that like they're more functional if what they represent is a totally faceless clone army, like where they are just tools. And if I don't want to step on your toes, but I remember there was another question someone asked about like, what do we think about this decision to sort of follow the kind of special quirky crew of clones rather than just a half dozen mm-hmm. regs?
Yes, let's talk.
And I think that. I think this is an area where it would have hit harder if they were all visually identical, aside from, you know, whatever individual decisions they'd make to style themselves differently, because it really would have hit that, like, this is what a version of ourselves, a version of our brothers that is going to continue to be enfranchised by the Empire is going to look like. They're going to look like droids.
Mm-hmm.
They're going to follow orders. They're going to kill. And they are not going to have a sense of selfhood, really, or self-preservation, or, you know, preservation of anyone else. They are going to be entirely instrumentalized by what their mission is, which I think is something that all of these characters spent so long figuring out that that is really what they were trying to avoid, rather than the more kind of like immediate bad consequences of whatever their current situation was. And I did really find it kind of effective, and this might be me projecting the reading that I wanted to see, but at the very end, when the last one of those guys is, you know, impaled to the wall, my interpretation visually was that Hunter feels a temptation to take the helmet off and look.
Yeah.
I read that as him having this dread in the pit of his stomach that the audience might, that might be tech.
Yeah.
That might have, you know, the particular hairline and sort of slightly sharper features of this man he loved deeply. And then choosing to live in sort of that negative capability. Because ultimately, what would knowing get him?
Right.
Again, personally, and case of point, this comes up again in Tales of the Empire. I feel like Star Wars in general really undersells how much it probably sucks to get thrown off a cliff.
It is not a binding problem. Yeah.
I obviously was sad when Tech fell off a cliff, but part of me was like, I hope just this once, like, he can stay at the ravine. So yeah, I would have been a little disappointed if it had been Tech. My pet theory earlier in the season that I'm ultimately also kind of happy they didn't go with, I sort of thought it might be like a adolescent Boba Fett, because I found his absence from this show a little conspicuous. He's a popular character. Maybe someone was like, oh, he's going to be in this other thing. But I just feel like there would have been an interesting interaction between him and Omega.
Oh God, yes. Well, I mean, young Boba Fett is like a dick. Completely understandably. I mean, like,
yeah,
who
I mean,
wouldn't be? Terrible things have happened. So it's kind of like, I can't even, It would have been rough for Omega, is all I'm saying.
But yeah, I agree with you. I think it worked out completely satisfactorily that they were anonymous and faceless.
And I think it's fine if somebody reads it otherwise. Like, that's one of the ambiguities that I'm okay with. Speaking of ambiguities I'm okay with, people have asked us, what do we think we should have seen more of Project Necromancer? What's funny to me is I kind of think we know what we need to know just from this. I don't object to it being elaborated on elsewhere, but I feel like a lot of what it means is telegraphed in this anyway.
Yeah. You know, I have a bad habit with sort of made up sci-fi technical details where I just sort of fade into white noise. It's possible that they explained too much about Project Necromancer and I just wasn't processing it.
No, they explained very little. I like see two things and I'm like, well, clearly it means X, Y, Z. So to me, based on the two things we know, that they're obsessed with tracking quote unquote M count, which somehow nobody on screen puts together as referring to midichlorians, but it's okay. Whatevs. We only know about that because we have seen the other movies. Yeah. I think they're trying to develop an ability to clone a Jedi body. And so they can have a cloned Jedi army. And so that's why they're looking for a clone, somebody who's clonable, who will have a high midichlorian count. As for the necromancer piece, I think it's because it's their way to bring back Jedis from the dead and or potentially something where they can help the Emperor put his brain into a new young body.
Yeah, I read it as much more Palpatine centric specifically, where it was like, he wants to live forever. We know that because for better or for worse, Rise of Skywalker exists. And we know that he's doing clone shit there and that he has some sort of, look, I don't know what a strand cast is, but he has some sort of strand cast son who goes off and is the father to Rey. So that much I get. Like, and my understanding, and this isn't like me saying anything meaningful, this is me legitimately being confused a little, is the implication that, like, if you just try to clone a Jedi, they will not necessarily be Force sensitive, or like, yep, they automatically won't. And so the idea is you need to fuse them. Like, I guess that's what the strand cast means.
And it's a nut they haven't been able to crack is how to make that work.
But like, Omega's blood has something where it can, like, you can clone someone else who is Force sensitive and through some quality of Omega's blood have the midichlorians carry through.
Or that her blood, because she is a clone and she has, God, shoot me now that I'm talking about midichlorians, because she is a clone and she's got special magic blood, then it shows you that there is a way to have something be clonable and have special magic blood.
Right. So hold on, does Boba Fett have special blood?
No, because she's a mutant. She has special magic blood.
Oh,
she's
all right.
A
now you're talking. Now you're speaking my language. So yeah, I think we got enough. I think if we'd gotten much more, I would have like gotten up to make popcorn. It's enough to know that, like, the Empire needs her for something that will ultimately, hypothetically, lead to the functional immortality of the Emperor.
Which we just know is going to be bad. So there you go. Yeah.
Yeah. What I was a little lost on is, like, we know that kind of happens anyway. So
that's always the Star Wars problem, right? It's something bad.
Yeah.
For reasons, the Empire came back.
I kind of thought there was going to be some sort of interesting reveal about Hemlock's hand because it's gloved and it always conspicuously shows him like sort of massaging it and almost like brandishing it when he wants to seem threatening. And so I thought, I don't know what I thought. I thought he was going to like whip it off and have like a Rodian hand or like a droid hand or something like that.
Be like, I engineered myself. Look at my mad scientist powers and tremble.
Yeah, there's a guy in the Kieran Gillen Darth Vader comic,
mm-hmm,
who has sort of bioengineered himself to be kind of good at this and that. He has sort of a Greedo Rodian eye and things like that. And in that story, his role is to sort of be like working with the Emperor to make kind of backup Darth Vaders, like a little Mon Calamari, Dr. Grievous guy, and sort of Space Fenris twins and things like that.
It's such a good issue.
Yeah, it's a really good arc. And so I was sort of thinking, like, I wonder if they're going to tie it into that. Like, has he been experimenting on himself in some way? But in the end, I'm fine with him just sort of being a weird, unsettling guy. And I do think we got enough about Project Necromancer. I think ultimately, you know, the prequels aren't perfect movies. In some ways, they're really pretty inept movies. But I feel like the Clone Wars have done such a good job of fleshing out and shoring up the weak points that, you know, now I can go back to them and enjoy myself because I'm thinking of like Ahsoka existing and things like that.
Yeah, that's such a good point. Like because of the other story work that's happened around it, it's more tolerable to watch this source material than it would have been otherwise.
Yeah, I feel like the past couple of years in particular, there have been a number of attempts to be like, well, no, this is how the Rise of Skywalker sort of makes sense. And I think I might be full up on that for the time being.
Yeah, we don't need, it's like, it is what it is, which isn't great. But as I've said to folks before, like I was old enough when Phantom Menace came out to know that it was very bad and just never gave any more of it a shot again. I was like, well, apparently Star Wars ended. And that was what I thought for a very long time, you know?
I think I was right on the cusp where I was really excited for it. And my brother, who was born in 1989, was super duper stoked for it. And sort of being aware in the theater that he was enjoying it more than me.
Mm-hmm.
And sort of feeling like, I really wanted to love this and there's a lot of it that is not working. And feeling myself becoming a little jaded in real time.
Yeah, you became, that's when you became an adult.
Yeah.
I entered a child and I left an adult.
Yeah, you don't survive your first Jar Jar experience with the innocence you entered with.
Intact. No.
Yeah. But yeah, this is something I was talking to Abby about. She was also a year or two younger than me when she saw it. And so, you know, seeing it again, she was really like, I cannot wait to see the pod race. I cannot wait to see the big duel at the end. And, you know, credit where credit's due. Those are really thrilling action sequences. Like, if I'm being completely honest, I enjoyed myself. Like, it's a pretty, I think I'm old enough now to know close friends with children who are of an age that would love it, that it's easier for me to love it than I was as like a preteen just on the cusp of adolescence.
Yeah.
But yeah, I feel like it's a fundamentally different labor for, you know, the Clone Wars writing room to be like, how can we take this sort of maximalist goofiness of the prequel trilogies and kind of put nuance in between the moments? And, you know, I've occasionally been an apologist for The Rise of Skywalker, but I think it's fundamentally a more or less incoherent movie. And I feel like after a certain point, it's really going to start being diminishing returns on explaining the basic inscrutable elements of it. That being said, I think that if you are telling a story about clones and it is set in this time, and if you want to do sort of a mad science, you know, medical atrocity storyline, this is sitting right there, and it would kind of be silly to not go for it. But yeah, I think I've heard enough for now about Palpatine's grody blood.
Yeah, I'm there with you. So Tales of the Jedi, I don't know why I found the first episode of it to be a bit dull, but it was 10 minutes, so whatever. I stuck with it.
When you were younger, like mid-90s, were you at all a fan of the kind of mid-90s Star Wars novels?
As a child, when I was young, there was three things. There was Star Wars, the Beatles, and there was Muppets. There was nothing else that existed. And then other things became to exist because I, you know, was a kid who interacted with people other than my parents and therefore developed other interests. But I was not aware of Star Wars again. And then I saw The Phantom Menace when I was a teenager who was old enough to know it was trash. And I never thought about any Star Wars. There was no other Star Wars. I didn't even know there were spinoff books.
Yeah. So you were a child of a certain temperament and of a certain age in like 1994, 1995. And this is something I've talked with our mutual friend Connor about. Seeing the Singing Mountain Clan witches was an event. Like, in the books, they are the baddest bitches imaginable.
Oh, so the witches of Darthamir who are in the mountains are a thing that, that you've been hearing about.
Yeah. There's one who becomes a Jedi and her arm gets cut off. So she learns how to lightsaber fight with one arm, and the hilt of her lightsaber is a big fang from one of those rancors. And so anything that kind of even gestures at her existing was like the 8-year-old in me pretty stoked. But I do think that first episode suffers by mostly spending a lot of time showing us stuff that we already knew about and have already seen with a slightly better kind of technological baseline for the animation.
And we know what's about to happen. Like, we know that those poor girls are all going to be dead. I mean, like, it's all foretold and very sad. And so you're kind of like, I'm watching this thing that's very sad that I saw coming.
It's a little bit like, I feel like General Grievous is a figure of such bathos You never really see him catch a W ever. So as much as I don't like it when, you know, people are massacred by a robot, he really sounded happy in this episode. Yeah. And I kind of appreciated seeing him in a moment where, like, Obi-Wan Kenobi wasn't on his way. And he was kind of just being able to do what he set out to do for once in his horrible life. But yeah, I think for the most part, it's kind of like the number of Order 66 flashbacks we've gotten over the past couple of years.
So many.
Where at a certain point, like, you understand why they keep showing it, because if for characters who were there, it was such a formative moment. But as an audience member, it's like you start to want something new from it if you're going to see it again.
Mm-hmm.
And in this, I feel like the actual, like, scene of carnage stretched maybe just a little bit too far without being additive. Like, obviously, we got to see the perspective of Morgan Elsbeth, who did not exist at the time that that scene was originally shot for the Clone Wars, what she was doing during it. But ultimately, what she was doing was fleeing in terror. Like, I think we could have filled in that gap ourselves.
And getting other idealistic teenagers killed. Don't forget that part.
Yeah.
Very believably, don't get me wrong, like, I bought all of them, but it was somehow both dull and sad. I do think the way they draw her, I mean, I could tell it, I could recognize it as the actress from the series, but I also thought she looked a lot like Keira Norris.
Yeah, I mean, I guess. I think that might be an interesting character to return to in talking about her, especially as a counterpoint to Barriss.
Mm.
I think one thing I'll say in favor of this episode being structured the way it was is because in the third episode, she has that line, "My world has always been burning."
Yeah.
And that is such a strong line, but I feel like it's one that you can't just drop in without showing the amount of gravity that it has for her. And so I think in that respect, seeing her go through this did have, you know, merit. I just feel like this series has such limited real estate and has to compress and be so economic with what it shows and what it doesn't show, that it did just feel a little strange that so much of it was the massacre and then so relatively little of it was her time with this other clan.
I got the sense that her time with the other clan wasn't very long at all. Like, they rescued her, yeah. She shows up and she gets them killed and is presumably banished. I feel like I was confused at how the next time we see her, she's a magistrate of a planet she's not from.
I don't think it's something that there's an existing story of, but I guess I found it plausible enough that she's, you know, talented and ambitious and found a place that had a power vacuum, especially because I feel like this series was kind of going out of its way to set up parallels with the Tales of the Jedi from last year, pairing Barriss with Ahsoka and Elsbeth with Dooku, where for that parallel to resonate, you kind of have to end with both of them in positions of power. I wonder if they could have reframed it so that the first episode started with her leaving Dathomir as the sort of sole survivor and showing her kind of coming to Corvus, I think it was, and sort of making inroads.
Yeah, because to me, like, the interesting story is less there was a massacre and more, how does this random person from a completely different planet end up in a powerful position where she's able to, like, present this plan to the... I really liked the scene of her going to do the PowerPoint for the Empire and, like, share her ideas and have them just be like, oh, we just want you for sheer resources and we're going to steal them now. It's just like, yeah, yes, that's how shit goes, motherfuckers. Like, that was
and that's
great.
That's another case where when it's like, the narrative being that the Empire does not have structural sexism, it's like, fuck you. It can't be the organization that it is in the narrative without having structural sexism. And that is absolutely what we see in this scene. Like, I would hazard that every woman who has ever given a presentation to an older man has had this happen, hopefully without a planet being ravaged, but with, you know, similarly poor outcomes. Mm-hmm. Like, it was so viscerally recognizable. I think a viewer would have to be sort of obtuse to not see how that was kind of like an intensely, intensely gendered scene.
Mm-hmm.
Which again makes it so funny to me that the guy at the other side of that is Grand Admiral Thrawn, who is a character I enjoy a lot, but at his worst does tend to be towards that sort of like the woke empire niche. Like, he's chivalrous. He is an alien who has sort of earned his way into a position of power here. But I think the scene that he's in interrogates that nicely, where he's not pushing her towards anything less monstrous. He's just pushing her something less boorish in its monstrousness.
Well, yeah. I mean, for him, like, he has thoroughly rationalized how what he wants isn't actually evil. And he says it so compellingly that there are some viewers who seem to take him at his word. But it's very believable that there's a person who's like that. And like the other thing is like, there are pieces of Thrawn being accepted into the Empire leadership, despite literally being an admiral in a different military, that are insane based on like how military works. But also like, there always are exceptions to these rules. That's how they kind of how they like lure people into thinking that they'll get to be one. So if there's one Thrawn, okay, so there's one Thrawn, you know, it's not like having like a suddenly diverse bridge crew.
Yeah. And I feel like Thrawn is always pointing towards this, like, well, maybe our genocidal war machine can be more of a meritocracy and less of a good old boys club, which is like, you know, that hire more female riot cops thing.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I mean, the thing is, like, there are people who genuinely believe that. So long as I don't have a problem with there being a character who believes that too, you know, they're just wrong.
Right.
But it definitely represents the opinions of like not an insignificant number of people.
Yeah. And I think that's the appeal of Thrawn. I mean, I think that's why he's been so popular for like 30 years, but also a character who's been so persistently misread as being like a truly like virtuous figure, I guess.
It was just so gross and not necessary, you know, really not necessary. Yeah. I mean, I think a lot of people's interest in him, I mean, he is competence porn, which people always enjoy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I really love him in Rebels because seeing a character use culture as a tool of analysis for understanding and winning fights is real and interesting to me. And like, I mean, that's fucking cool. So like, I enjoy that. But I am not here to say anything other than Thrawn is a monster. Of course, he's a complete monster, you know. And but it also, like, if somebody was going to go and make a recruit of Morgan Elspeth, like, it would be him. That does make sense because he wouldn't hold her gender or alien status or whatever against her. He would see that, in fact, as bringing interesting dynamics and experiences to use towards the cause of evil.
We see Elspeth, she burns the forest as sort of like this show of intimidation, which mm-hmm. I think is the most effective parallel to Dooku, where I think she probably could not even identify the point where she goes from earnestly believing incorrectly that she's working in the benefit of these people to mouthing those sentiments while kind of fairly sadistically punishing them for having any thought of agency. Like, I thought it was so on the nose, but also so astute at the end of that third episode where she says, you know, I've done this in your protection. But then literally the next sentence says the fires will continue to burn and you will be working day and night. And I think it works as a counterpart to have that dynamic with Dooku couched in sort of a very kind of rigid sense of noblesse oblige, which gets kind of metastasized. Whereas we see Elspeth take that almost isometric kind of moral decline, but it's framed explicitly within industry. You know, I think with Star Wars, it's often kind of trying to squeeze blood out of a stone to do a specifically kind of like a Marxist analysis of it.
Mm-hmm.
But here in particular, it is so blunt in a way that I was really kind of like, you know, like some 7-year-old's going to see this and like think about what these sort of like human collateral of mass industry is, kind of couched within this cautionary tale about not being a murder witch.
Let's talk about the Barriss series. I've thoroughly enjoyed that. I've always wondered what would happen to her after from that point on. And, you know, somebody asked us if we thought that. They said, Barriss and Lynn both join in a pretty storied tradition of sympathizing with hurt people who hurt people. Do you think characters in Star Wars are redeemed too much? I have to say that with Barriss, having Barriss redeemed this way is like kind of the only thing that makes sense. Now, did Barriss intentionally frame Ahsoka?
I believe she was intentionally framing things because there's that whole bit of business where Ahsoka goes to interrogate the other suspect. And he is force choked to death. And it looks like Ahsoka did it from the security cams.
But it's obviously Barriss. Barriss is really good at that. Right. So she's doing it.
Yeah.
So Barriss is terrible to Ahsoka. But that overall, yeah. Barriss is somebody who is motivated by wanting to stop war. And her joining the Inquisitors is clearly her trying to not be killed. And so having her defect and try to undo the damage she did makes sense. And I also feel like in a lot of longer series, they would have had her go through like so many different villages and letting this happen before she finally snapped. And having her just deal with it right away. And this felt much more believable, frankly. I don't want to have to watch her. Like, how many times do you need to see this, you know? So I actually thought this worked really well.
I think you're right. And I think this is an area where the extreme economy of having to tell a story like this in about 45 minutes really is to its benefit. Because if you prefer to believe that she's gone on other missions like this, you're totally free to. If you want to believe that this is her first mission out, you're free to do that as well. And I think it is significant, as you mentioned, that from her perspective in the Clone Wars, she is absolutely doing something that is difficult and a little bit ugly, but pragmatically correct. And so I think the only area where I'd want to push back is that I do think there's an element of self-preservation in her joining the Inquisitorius. But also, again, from her perspective, from everything that she can suss together from her jail cell, is it everything that she believed and was willing to, you know, act on was borne out? When Lynn tells her that the Jedi, you know, suddenly turned on the Emperor and tried to stage a coup, she has no reason to disbelieve that, because that's absolutely consonant with what she believes and what she saw and sort of the conduct of the war up to that point. There's that scene in the kind of middle episode of this where they go to the planet where the Jedi had been being sheltered, and she sees how destitute it is and sort of comments about why has the Emperor allowed this to persist?
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like what's so acute about that to her is that she let herself believe that that kind of exploitation and that kind of like desolation and that kind of neglect of people was a symptom of the Republic specifically. And I think she truly believed that with the Jedi out of the picture and sort of the kind of bloat of the Republic out of the picture, that anything that would fill that gap would by necessity have to be better for the people. And so I think seeing that shock to her system come so closely before the more like dramatically kind of high stakes shock of seeing Lynn, you know, massacre people and then kill someone she was talking to really works to show that I think more than any other Inquisitor that we see in Star Wars, she is entering into this in good faith.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, basically with mental math, that it's pretty legible how she gets to the conclusions that she gets to. It would be easier to make her come off as someone who always had some like level of sadism in her or hypocrisy, or to play her as sort of a buffoon. So I was really happy with how much kind of dignity this story let her have.
Mm-hmm.
Even when we see her kind of falling into this really sort of bleak place.
Yep. And I also feel like there was little touches of just her, like, for example, like force choking, like Barriss is just the queen of force choking, you know, that's just like one of her primary skills. So, I was happy to see her sort of not conclusively dead at the end of this, actually, potentially.
Yeah, I think if she's dead, I'm going to be a little bit pissy.
Given that ending, like, if she was going to die, she would have died before she was getting carried out of there, you know, but...
Yeah. But I think to get back to the broader question of, do we think that Star Wars as a franchise is a little bit too free-handed with redemption? I think no.
Yeah,
with the caveat that I almost always find a well-done redemption are compelling. And, you know, in general, in real life, as well as in fiction, I try as hard as I can to believe that people can opt to do better things and make better choices than they had at like their worst moments. Not as like a, you know, get out of jail free card, but just as like, to me, you know, I don't like any of the alternative narratives. And I think for the most part, like, yes, there are a shit ton of redemption stories in Star Wars. And I think that's because it's baked into it from Return of the Jedi. And sometimes they're more compelling than others. But I think for the most part, the ones that really work are the ones where that redemption feels hard earned. And I think with both Barriss... Oh, go ahead.
And it's not like we feel like Darth Vader gets some great redemption where he gets to like spend the rest of his days out on a beach. He dies.
Right.
He still suffers greatly.
You know? Yeah. I mean, I guess we see him in like Force Ghost Heaven. But I think insofar as there is something beautiful to Jedi ideology, it is in that making the right decision when it counts can be kind of totally redemptive in a way where, again, these are family movies and, you know, a 6-year-old who's at them isn't going to want to be told like, yeah, Luke's dad is in hell forever. But I think case in point, like, Barriss doesn't get an easy redemption. We see her living in what seems like pretty trying circumstances, actively helping people every day.
Really weathered. Like, she has seen some shit.
Very weathered, which is especially interesting to me because as a little, like, lore tidbit, we now know that her species can live to be pretty old. We've seen people her species who are about 200 and look maybe like 40 or 45. So I think the implication is definitely deliberately that she's been living very hard. That also seems like she has found like purpose and meaning that she did not have with the Jedi.
Yep.
Another kind of like weird lore thing, which is totally like tangential, is pre the Clone Wars, she had a full arc that was quite different where she just kind of got blown up by a tank in a comic at the end, like towards the end of the Clone Wars.
So she's from a comic before she was in the, she was originally from a comic, not from the TV show?
I think she's like she's one of those like background characters in Attack of the Clones, I think.
Okay.
But there's actually two novels about her where she is specifically a Jedi who is a field medic. And so there's this long tradition of her as someone who is conflicted about being pushed into the role of a soldier and kind of thrives more in the position of being a healer. And so I really, really liked that this kind of path of redemption for her involved her entirely giving up like her weaponry, her means of like warfare, and finding this like new life as a healer and a sort of a shepherd to people.
Yeah, that's fucking cool.
And again, I don't think the story is, it doesn't feel like hagiographical. Like, it doesn't feel like it is like lionizing her in a particular way. I liked the implication that she is as shocked as Lynn that she doesn't just straight up get murdered and die in that cave. I think she left her little prefab hut completely expecting to die in a way that was, you know, selfless, but also a little bit self-serving. And that I think it fit her narrative of herself and her narrative of guilt to be like, okay, eventually somebody finds me and I die. And so I think it was really beautiful to have her leave it with the door open for there to be more of her. And to have that door open by virtue of someone else's kind of path of atonement and path of bettering themselves beginning.
Are there things that you think a casual Star Wars viewer should know about Barriss other than that? Because that was an interesting point to share with us. Just something that you felt like really brought some additional richness or appreciation to it.
Yeah. I think her whole deal and her species' whole deal kind of frustrate me because they're really interesting and they show up in a lot of stuff and are often pretty popular characters. But there's a lot of little strange details that are kind of tucked away in odd places or just not really addressed directly at all. Like, you know, in the cartoon, well, I mean, I guess this is a cartoon too. You know how in the Clone Wars, her and her master Luminara, they both have head coverings on at all times?
Yes.
And there's a really brief moment in the arc where she blows up the hangar, where we see her private dormitory, her little like apartment or whatever. And you can see like in one shot, she has this little shrine set up that is very much not like a Jedi shrine. And there's this detail that is never really played up that her species, when they become Jedi, they often continue to practice sort of their kind of own religious and sort of spiritual practices, which is why they're often like paired Padawan and Master together, which informed so much of the story to me because it made me really pay attention to when she has her head covering on and when she doesn't. Because with her and Luminara in particular, the consistent implication, although again, like frustratingly, the like details of this have never really been spelled out. It's not just like a fashion accoutrement. It's something of some sort of spiritual significance to them. And so I think it's significant that we see her permitted to keep it on when she's in Republican imprisonment.
Yeah.
We see her allowed to have it when she is actively on duty as an inquisitor. But when she's in this sort of initiation period, she is not permitted to have it, as if she's sort of being or put through this process of like humiliation or like being purged of her existing like kind of cultural attachments.
Yes.
And then, you know, we see her without it when she is in her home with this family. But she puts it back on as soon as she exits out again, takes it off again when she sees... Well, does she take it off again when she sees its land, or does she put it...
She does. She takes it off.
Yeah. So, like, it's frustrating because I feel like someone has the rules of this written down, but it's not something that the audience is quite privy to.
Mm-hmm.
And you can sort of make, like, extrapolations or guesses based on like real life practices, but I feel like that's always so risky.
Yeah.
And then there's stuff like their facial markings are a cultural thing that they get at a like around adolescence, I think it is. But okay. Then we see other Muriel and Jedi in like earlier periods who just don't do any of this at all. Hmm. Who just kind of wear the Jedi robes and have unmarked faces and sort of like a human master. So there's this entire other story about assimilation. This is what I wanted to circle back around to from talking about Dungey. What it means when you're sort of plucked away from your home as an infant and dropped into this other sort of way of life that expects you to conform with pretty intense rigor. And I feel like there's potential for that to come through especially sharply with Muriel and Jedi. And, you know, I think it would be a difficult story to tell. And I think it's a story where they would, you know, you would probably want like a writer of color to tell it rather than like, I don't think Dave Filoni actually wrote this issue for this episode, but let me actually look that up. Tales of the Empire, written by Nicholas Anastasiou, Matt Michnovitz, and Matt Michnovitz. So I think there's stuff to dig into, but that everyone is sort of aware enough to know that it requires some sensitivity that is not necessarily the default in a Star Wars story.
Mm-hmm. Sounds right to me. So one thing I'm excited to announce is that Holly and I, as well as other people you have heard on Graphic Policy Radio, like Kyahton Klein, and
Josie Reisman, the authoress of True Believer, The Rise and Fall of Stan Lee, and now that amazing wrestling history book, Ringmaster, Vince McMahon, and The Unmaking of America.
We are all doing a panel together at FlameCon where we'll be talking about what do us queer weirdos love so much about a range of things that I will refer to as the nerd canon, that were perhaps not designed with people like us in mind, such as original Star Wars, Silver Age comics, professional wrestling. You know, there is so much conversation in queer spaces about the importance of representation and own voices work. And that's all so fucking real. But we do also like some shit that was definitely made by old white men for other old white men. And we want to sort of look at what it is that makes those works work for us. If you've listened to this podcast, you've certainly heard me talk about it before. And now we'll be bringing that to the FlameCon stage at a panel for FlameCon called Queer Eye on the Straight Geek Canon. So I hope folks will come and check that out. FlameCon actually has COVID prevention protocols at the conference, which is why I'm able to go there. And that really matters. Please bring and wear on your face, not around your neck, an actual mask, N95, KF, KN95, like a real respirator mask. Help preserve your safety, my health, etc. And we'll see you in New York City in August. I'm so excited.
Yeah. I am working on some stuff for it. I am very stoked.
Hooray. I love to hear it. So, Graphic Policy Radio, we will be back soon, very soon, with the coverage of X-Men 97. I mean, to be perfectly honest, I think I probably would have been speaking up front about Bad Batch in more completely glowing terms if I wasn't still kind of like high off like the emotions that I'm experiencing from X-Men 97, which is kind of like the best thing ever. So, you know, it's sort of an interesting contrast for me. But anyway, so that'll be coming up on the podcast very soon, as well as a follow-up episode of Deep Space Dive. And as always, more comics coverage. I am on Blue Sky, the best social network so far, at LEVIN. And if, you know, I'm still on the other place, but basically just for work, with ELANA_Brooklyn. And thank you for all your support for the podcast, guys. And I have another remastered episode of Venture Brothers with Steven that will be sharing again soon. And with that, keep it geeky.